Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lou Dobbs interviewing Jesuit Tom Reese of Georgetown University.
Does the church, though, or the Council of Bishops, Father, make any reference to the fact that we bring more than 3 million people a year into the United States legally? That we made more than a million people, U.S. citizens, naturalized more than a million immigrants last year as U.S. citizens, that almost half of them were Hispanic, because you make it sound as if there's some sort of constraint here to do things legally. We had a president running around for 8 years saying things like we need a guest worker program. We have 13 of them in this country. Why the duplicity, why the deceit, why the obfuscation in this debate rather than clarity and transparency, openness and honesty?
Well, I would like to see a program that actually worked. I mean, it can take 20 years for someone to get a visa to rejoin their family. This is just not a system that's working. What we need is a system that actually works, that allows people to get a visa, come here legally, and allows the, you know what, 10 million people who are here already, that have been living here, that have children born in the United States. There are 3.1 million children who were born in the United States of people who are here undocumented. They are American citizens. The government is threatening to take their parents away from them and send them back to the country they lived in. These are children who are American citizens.
You didn't answer a single question I asked, Father, but then again, you're a Jesuit. You can get away with that.
Greetings, and welcome to Mystery Babylon News Radio on February 22nd, 2013. The book, Washington in the Lap of Rome, in 1888, I came upon it about 3 years ago. It's up on the internet. You can download it as a PDF file. But the book I'm going to be reading from is from Noise of Thunder Radio, and by Christian Pinto. To buy this book, you can go to the start of the program there on my list there, and you'll see a link to click to. Now, the reason I'm reading this book is because it's moved me. I mean, in other words, it's so easy to see who is running our government now if you have the pieces of the puzzle. Who founded America and who runs the U.S. government? We can see our liberties, and we can see the oppressive laws day by day and the escalation of this Orwellian state that has come upon America. And the best book I could put in your hands, and my main goal here tonight is for you to research this book. But for you to just read this book cold, you need some background, you need some history. Your roots are only as deep as your history. And as Justin Fulton said, they have murdered history. Some people say they're rewriting history. No, what they're doing is they're just leaving out a big part of history. And the biggest part of history that the Americans don't know is English history. Now, I'm going to give you a little quiz here, and they're up there on my billboard for this program. I'm going to give you 10 questions, and over this broadcast, this series, because I plan on reading this entire book on the air. The first question is, what part in colonial history did Charles Carroll of Carrollton play in the founding of America? Number two, who donated the land where the U.S. Capitol was built? Who founded Georgetown University? Who sailed on the Ark and the Dove in 1634? Who was the first mayor of Washington, D.C.? Of the original 13 colonies, which one was Catholic? Which English king was executed for high treason? Who was the Queen of England at the time of the Spanish Armada? Who was the mother of King James I of England? In English history, who was Guy Fawkes? Now, listeners, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have got not one of these questions right. And what I have gleaned from my studies is the word ignorance. The word ignorance, there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not our fault that our English history has been taken away from us, because you see, English history is American heritage. I want to quote from The Foreign Conspiracies Against the Liberties of the United States by Samuel Morse in 1835. Samuel Morse was the inventor of the Morse Code. He said, "The food of popery is ignorance. Ignorance is the mother of papal devotion. Ignorance is the legitimate prey of popery. Ignorance, the condition of being uneducated, unaware, or uninformed." And the lead-in from Lou Dobbs, when he asked the question, he asked Tom Rees, you know, why is it that the Jesuits are, in other words, this is the opposite of what Lou Dobbs said. Why is it that the Jesuits are filled with duplicity? This is describing the Jesuit organization. Duplicity, deceit. Why are the Jesuits filled with obfuscation and debate rather than clarity and transparency, openness and honesty in debate? Now, it's real important. I find that the average person, the Jesuits are running transparent. People do not know about the Jesuits. When were the Jesuits formed? They were formed in 1540. The Reformation by Martin Luther in 1517 and the Council of Trent in 1540. They met for about 3 or 4 years to counter the Reformation. Everything that we see in history today for the last 400 years has been to counter the Reformation. Now, before I get into the book, I'd like to just read the back cover. Back cover, it says, "Washington in the Lap of Rome, 1888. And this is a quote from Justin Fulton. "Romanism is the dominant power in the capital of the United States." And this is on the back of the cover of the book, not by Justin Fulton. "In 1888, a man named Justin D. Fulton gave warning to the people of America through his book, Washington in the Lap of Rome. In it, he details how the Roman Catholic Church flooded the new capital city just after the American Revolution with the intention of seizing control of the United States by covert means. Now, prior to the Revolution, Catholics in America were forbidden to vote and could not hold political office because of the centuries-old conflict between Rome and England, an enemy so bitter that even the Catholic Mass was outlawed in the early English colonies. But once America declared her independence and the doctrine of religious freedom was written into the Constitution, the agents of the Pope moved quickly, building a Jesuit university, taking over hospitals, and moving faithful Romanists into the positions of power. By 1888, the situation was such that Fulton wrote, Romanism is the dominant power in the capital of the United States. In the 19th century, The author was convinced that if Americans did not wake up to the problem, it would be a matter of time before Jesuit priests would rule over our country and the Inquisition would come to American soil. Was there any truth to Fulton's warning? The new edition of Fulton's book presents a 70-page foreword by documentary filmmaker Christian J. Pinto that attempts to answer the questions. Pinto reveals the influence of Rome from 1888 to the present time, documenting the role of the Vatican during World War II, with the development of the CIA, the Vietnam era, the Jesuit origins of communism, McCarthyism, the Mexican border issue, the rewriting of American history, the Catholic-dominated Supreme Court, the manipulation of the White House, and even the moderate presidency of Barack Obama. Is our country being manipulated by Wall Street money men, or by an ancient power that has longed to rule the world for more than 1,000 years? Now, I'm getting ready to read the 7th chapter out of the book The Grand Design by the author John Daniel. If you're listening and you're on the internet, you can go to The Grand Design Exposed, and at the top of the page I have a link. Right at the very top it says English History, American Heritage. Click here. Now, it's very important to know English history. If you don't know English history, there's no way you'll ever really understand the American Revolution. History flows, and most Americans' history start at 1776. Now, I'm going to start reading the book, the chapter, chapter 7 of The Grand Design Exposed, English History, American Heritage. A princess married, then rejected. With a brief reflection on history, we can get a glimpse of how events started 40 years before the Jesuit order was founded, was to lead to later intrigues and conspiracies that constantly kept all of Europe in a state of bloody and violent uprisings. Efforts spurred on by Rome and her Jesuits, with seething hatred and vengeance, instigated to repulse the advancement of Protestantism. It was in the year 1501 that the youngest daughter of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel of Spain was married at age 15 to Prince Arthur, the brother of Henry VIII of England. At this very same time, Christopher Columbus, who was seeking permission from the King and Queen of Spain for his fourth and last voyage to the New World, was being postponed because of the wedding. However, the marriage of Catherine of Aragon, as she was known, to Prince Arthur was short, for he died within the year. It not being normally lawful for a man to marry his brother's widow, yet with some string pulling and with the reason given that it would unify the kingdoms of England and Spain, a papal dispensation was granted. Catherine remarried Henry VIII of England in 1509. It being Henry's first wife, Catherine had 6 children by Henry, of which only one named Mary survived. Mary later, in 1553 to 1558, became Queen of England and tried to restore Roman Catholicism by burning over 300 Protestants as heretics. She earned the name Bloody Mary. Now you know where the name for the drink, the alcohol drink, Bloody Mary, comes from. King Henry VIII wanted a male heir, which Catherine was not providing. Meanwhile, as a pretense, Henry began to feel some scruples as to the validity of his marriage to his brother's widow. He applied to Pope Clement VII for an annulment. Catherine then appealed to her nephew, German Emperor Charles V, for help. Though the influence of Emperor Charles V, the Pope denied Henry an annulment. Henry, determined to be free of the marriage, obtained his own annulment, declaring his marriage with Catherine invalid in 1533 without the Pope's consent. This led to Henry VIII's separation from Rome and excommunication. In rebellion against the authority of the Pope, Parliament passed the Act of Supremacy Law, making the King the supreme head of the Church of England in place of the Pope. Parliament also enacted statutes suppressing the monasteries in England and confiscated all their property. That's how England became wealthy. England at this time, I want to give a piece of history that has been just left out of history. England is the only country that ever had a Protestant government. They legislated Catholicism illegal, and they wouldn't let the Catholics hold office. Now, in America, we have a universal government. Our government was built on religious liberty, but it's a universal government. It's not a Protestant government, but it's built on Protestant principles. Now, King Henry VIII was an unscrupulous and tyrannical monarch. In all, he had 6 wives, 2 he had beheaded. Yet the greatest scandal of England was the notoriously immoral lives of the clergy, especially the monks, where the 2/3 were frauds, gluttons, worldly sensational, living in concubines, and peddlers of indulgence and relics. The lives of nuns, being not much better, were also scandalously immoral. They were a hindrance to a royal authority, and the excess gold and silver sent to Rome to replenish the papal treasure was a severe drain that weakened the resources of Henry's realm. Henry cleaned it up, stopped the flow of wealth to Rome, and confiscated the Pope's properties. In essence, he conducted a much-needed reform. Religion did not motivate Henry. Instead, he was obsessed with strengthening his royal throne. In fact, Henry hated the doctrines of Lutheran and detested Protestants. He never gave up the Mass or the dogmas of the Roman faith, but made them law for the Church of England. However, even though Henry brought down upon his head and his English kingdom the hatred and anathemas of Rome, he also threw wide open the door for the English Reformation. A deadly contest. What Henry began in England soon developed into a deadly contest that became spearheaded by zealous Jesuits urging on raging Roman Catholics who vigorously opposed the English government and denied the right of a Protestant even to live. That Jesuit contempt for what Protestants hold most precious, the free circulation of the scriptures among the people, free inquiry, and private judgment, died even until today. It spanned the sea, right into the English colonies of the New World, and quietly planted its diseased roots in the seat of the fledgling American government, biding its time. In spite of Henry VIII's fanatical despotism, which only reflected his Roman Catholic heritage, he paved the way for freedom we Americans enjoy today and take so much for granted, as Rome now lurks behind the scenes, poised to steal it all away. It must be seen by anyone who has given the slightest thought and study into this subject that the intense struggle here is not just about religion, but something vastly more important. Religion is only a tool, a vehicle, the perfect means to reach an end, a system to become rich and powerful, absolute. All religion is false, man-made. To worship the God of creation and truth is not religion, but truth indeed, where only love, peace, and joy reigns. Both Pope and King alike who were conceived to rule and regulate the masses, positions of power and luxury that only corrupts the mind and character. The noble aristocrat looked upon all who were below his status as less than human. They were his slaves, their lives worth nothing other than to work his fields, cook his food, dig his gold, make his clothes, dress him, be there for every beck and call. For an aristocrat to get his hands dirty from menial labor was a disgrace. Columbus could write in his log how sweet and gentle a people the natives of the New World were, and then bring back a boatload chained as slaves. That's an aristocrat mentality. They have no conscience, no feeling, no compassion for anyone they judge below them. You might think we're kind of seeing that a little bit in our government today. Things are changing. I think we've all seen the change. In their arrogant, haughty, conceited, self-centered minds, how could they ever imagine inferiors to be able to think independently, to have a voice in government, and run their own lives? It just wasn't natural. Stirred to a fanatical fear and desperation, and seeing a social change where nobles could lose all control in the name of religion, they rallied to call Ignatius and join his Jesuit soldiers. The Jesuit institution. The Jesuits took to the field as they added to their numbers. They were everywhere. Each was assigned to the task which his talents or his disposition best adapted. To one, the instruction of children. To another, a career of letters or science. Some planted their missionary stations among the Peruvian gold mines or in the marts of African slave trade, among the islands of the Indian Ocean, in the cities of Japan and China, in the recesses of Canada's forests. They had the most important chairs in the university. They had control of the schools of Italy, France, Australia, and Spain, and they became the most elegant, learned, and fashionable preachers in all Catholic countries. They grew to be a clandestine institution, an organization with 20,000 eyes upon every cabinet, every palace, and every private family in Catholic Europe, and 20,000 arms extended around the necks of every sovereign and all their subjects assigned to the care of royal consciousness, whereby unseen, their whispering word would guide the destiny of nations. They adapted their doctrines to the taste of the rich and powerful, and the elegance and arrogance and worldliness of their dignitaries. Jesuit La Chaise traveled in a coach with six horses and was an elegant and most polished man of the world. He had to be in order to be selected by King Louis the 14th of France to be confidential and in an influential confessor. And no matter how low his station or elevated his position, in the backwoods of America or king courts of Europe, superiors had to make long and detailed reports of every act of significance and were required to send them to the Jesuit general in Rome. Those in Italy, once a month, elsewhere in Europe, every 4 months, and those overseas annually, source materials to guide the world back to Rome. Rome's atrocities. Volumes have been written about the horrendous accounts of Protestant blood spilled during the 150 years following the founding of the Jesuit order. Many counter, well, Protestants killed too. Yes, and in answer to that, any man worth being a man, when someone comes into his home to rape and butcher his wife and dash his children to pieces, certainly will fight and kill too, if need be, to save those he loves. To read an account is quite different than having to live through it. To literally witness the terrible scene and to see those you hold dear being mangled and slaughtered before your eyes has to make an image so vivid, never able to be erased. And yet, some of the most horrible scenes ever to take place where during that time period, far too many and much too savage to try to describe. It must take an awful cold heart and a willful blindness not to see the overwhelming atrocities that Rome and her cohorts have inflicted upon the human beings of this world. Not even to mention the wholesale genocide of the South American Inca and other nations who were systematically worked to death digging for silver and gold, or other natives on islands in the West Indies and Caribbean, where today there is no trace of aboriginals. The very place where Columbus landed, planted the cross, and ceremoniously dedicated the New World to the Pope, where in those same islands the population is 90% Catholic. And in some of these islands, its people are the poorest in the world. No, we won't get into any of that. Instead, we will just touch on six of the most dramatic events, those your own reference books will confirm, just six among the others, too numerous, and history really wants to forget anyhow. Okay. Queen Mary. When Henry VIII of England died, he left one son, Edward, and two daughters, Mary and Elizabeth. Edward VI was 10 years old when he came to the throne, but because of sickness reigned only 6 years, favoring Protestantism, and then died. Mary, who had become a very embittered lady because of the harsh treatment by her father, I might say here, this is really interesting to intersect, you see, her mother was asked to leave the palace because he married Anne Boleyn. And so you can understand why Mary was so embittered. And understand some of the things she's called Bloody Mary, but understand there were Jesuits that were behind Bloody Mary. She wasn't acting totally on herself. Determined to reverse what her father had done religiously and bring England back under the Roman Catholic Church, she took the first step that could ensure powerful backing by marrying in 1554 Philip of Spain, the son of her cousin, Emperor Charles V. The same emperor that her mother appealed to for help to save her marriage. This union, along with reestablishing Roman Catholicism, brought great consternation and distress among the people of England. To crush all opposition, she began a reign of terror, with over 300 Protestants being executed. She too died early of sickness at age 42, having reigned only 5 years. But the 5 years fixed forever in the minds of the English people out of fear and dread, if for nothing else, to hate and be weary of everything that was Roman Catholic. The Protestant Church of England, also named Anglin after Angles, the Germanic tribe from which England derives its name, and also the name Episcopal, became permanently the official religion of England. But not without an intense contest. Please understand, dear readers, it was not Mary, it was her confessors, the Jesuits, that earned her the name of Bloody Mary. The second one is the Bartholomew Massacre. Huguenot Protestants in France united together and became a show of real strength, causing great concern for 22-year-old King Charles IX and his dominant mother, Catherine, who actually was the real power behind the throne. Upon Catherine's suggestion, a plan was put forth to rid the Protestant Huguenots once and for all. A royal wedding was arranged in Paris, France, between Margaret of Valois and the sister of Charles IX and Henry of Bourbon, a Protestant nobleman. A deceptive gesture to bring religious unity and peace to France. Knowing that the royal event would bring many thousands of Protestants to Paris, plans were carefully laid for the date of 24th August, 1572, at midnight, and at the ringing of the church bells, to become the time and signal to begin a massacre of all Protestants in the city. The massacre, as it is known in history, began in Paris, but then quickly spread to other provinces all over France, continued over a week without gory details. It was reported that close to 100,000 Protestants were butchered unmercifully during those days. The River Seine literally ran red with Protestant blood and could not carry away all the headless, mutilated, and putrefied corpse. It was so full, upon Pope Gregory the 13th hearing the news, the same Pope who led Bavarian mathematical Jesuit Clavius to devise the Gregorian calendar, the one we use today. He rejoiced, ordered a jubilee and celebration, and had a medal struck in commemoration of the glorious Catholic achievement. The Spanish Armada. Now, one of the questions I asked at the beginning, it was about the Spanish Armada. When I'm out and about or visiting somebody and I ask the question about the Spanish Armada and people don't know, I don't go any further. Because to understand what is going on to this day in America, if you don't understand the Spanish Armada, you'll never pick up on what's happened here in America. And that all roads lead to Rome. The Spanish Armada. In England, 14 years before the Bartholomew Massacre, Elizabeth, the younger half-sister of Mary, took the throne as queen. With flint-like determination, she set a course to rule England that favored Protestantism. Imagine here what the Pope Pius was saying. Again, always remember, England was the only country to outlaw and legislate Catholicism illegal and to have a Protestant government. Below, Pope Pius V put a contract on the life of Elizabeth. Just imagine if this was taught in our schools. This is history that just is not being taught, and over the years has swept out of the minds. The Pope putting a contract on Elizabeth's life. Pope Pius V, quote, this was the contract on Elizabeth. We declare the aforesaid Elizabeth to be a heretic and a better of the heretics. And we declare her and her supporters to have incurred the sentence of excommunication. We declare her to be deprived of her pretended claim to the aforesaid kingdom and of all lordships, dignity and privilege whatsoever. Also, we declare that the lords, subjects, and peoples of said kingdom and all others who have sworn allegiance to her are perpetually absolved from any oath of fidelity and obedience. Consequently, we absolve them and we deprive the same Elizabeth of her pretended claim to the kingdom, and we command and forbid her lords, subjects, and peoples to obey her. We shall bind those who do the contrary with similar sentence of excommunication. Understand, Elizabeth reigned the throne in 1558, and she reigned for 45 years. There was over 20 attempts to assassinate Elizabeth. So haughty are the claims of these degenerate men to believe in their minds to be the Pontiff Maximus, the high priest, God's representative on earth, sunbaal worship, which is Roman Catholicism. As such, they believe they have unlimited power to depose every monarch, hand over every country to foreign invasion, deprive everyone of his possessions without legal process. Does that sound familiar, what's going on today? Can you see that in America happening? Anyone offering help to one disposed, even basic human kindness, would be excommunicated. This peril stared Elizabeth straight in the face, as behind the scenes, the popes and the Jesuits encouraged civil disobedience. That's what we see in the taking of the guns, left against right, Republican against Democrat, white against black. That is all coming from our social engineers. It's not an accident of what has happened. They want civil disorder. They want civil disorder. That's what the reason why with the guns. They're not really interested in the guns. What they want is they want a reprisal. They want somebody to stand up to them so they can show their force. This peril stared Elizabeth straight in the face as behind the scenes the popes and the Jesuits encouraged civil disobedience. However, the popes, and as incredible as it seems in Elizabeth's 45-year reign, she saw 9 popes come and go. They all fully underestimated the patriotism of the English people and the English oak heart of their queen. Below is a speech delivered by Elizabeth to the land forces assembled at Tilbury. Understand that they amassed 130 ships, France and Spain, and were coming sailing down on England. England had only 60 ships. They were sailing to make England Catholic. If they'd have been successful, I would be talking in Spanish, or most likely, I wouldn't be talking. Because there's no freedom of speech, no freedom of press, and no freedom of liberty, nor freedom of religion in Romanism, in a papist government. This is what the queen, she went down to the shores, and she came down on her white horse right to the shore, and she gave this speech to her people. My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But I assure you, I do not desire to live and to distrust my faithful and loving people. Let tyrants fear. I have always so behaved myself that under God I have placed my chiefest strength, safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects, and therefore I am come amongst you, as you see, at this time, not for my recreation and disport, but being resolved in the midst and heat of the battle, to live and die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and my people, my honor and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body, but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king and of a king of England too, and thankful for foul score that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm, to which rather than any dishonor shall grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general, judge, and rewarder of every one of your virtues in the field. I know already, for your foreignness, you have deserved rewards and crowns. And we do assure you, in the word of the prince, they shall be duly paid you. In the meantime, my lieutenant general shall be in my stead. Then whom never prince commanded a more noble or worthy subject, not doubting, but by your obedience to my general, by your concord in the camp and your valor in the field. We shall shortly have a famous victory over those enemies of my God, of my kingdom, and of my people. A mighty fleet was prepared with numerous war guns and ships and large transports. 131 ships in all carried over 30,000 men. Two-thirds of them were soldiers. The Spanish Invincible Armada, it was called, as it boasted its superior weapons and awesome number of strength. They were on a deadly mission, never doubting for an instant anything but success. With breeze filled with white sails glistening in the sunlight that put in motion that day on the 22nd of July, 1588, the spectacular and proud Armada glided out of the Spanish harbor destination, England. Mission invasion to bring the English under Spanish control to full submission of the Holy Roman Catholic Church, to teach this upstart usurper, legitimate bastard, heretic of a queen, and all her heretic subjects with her a lesson. Ambitious mission indeed. The English had advanced knowledge of the coming Armada, and so kept close watch of it, with the preparations made to give warning signals at the first sighting. Then the reality was upon them, as all England became alive with the news that the mighty fleet was approaching, spotted by a patrol 100 miles off the coast. The English Navy sprung into action as it put out to sea to engage the enemy. Catholic Spain, the most powerful European nation of time, against a small Protestant England, the scope of what was at stake here was tremendous. The common man fighting for human rights in protest of the aristocrat forcing him to be his slave. As the Spanish Armada advanced up the English Channel, it formed a crescent battle formation with most of their gunships on either side of the crescent and transports in the center. The English fleet met them with 60 gunships that were smaller but more maneuverable, with heavier and longer range cannons and seamen who were excellent gunners to break up the Spanish formation. The English, under cover of darkness, sent in several fire ships filled with explosives, which set the Spanish fleet into panic. From then on, the battle was in the English favor. The Spanish were outmaneuvered, outgunned, and outclassed, driven on the run into the North Sea. Here, the limping Spanish fleet made a fatal decision to return home by going north of Scotland and around the west side of the British Isles and Ireland. Severe storms battered the already damaged and leaking remaining ships to pieces. The whole operation became a Spanish disaster, with nearly a half of the ships lost and three-quarters of the men dead. I'm not quite done with that chapter. We'll finish that on part two, but I do want to say one thing here. There is a movie. It's a Hollywood movie. It was made in 1969 with Richard Burton. It's a two-movie collection. It's called Anne of a Thousand Days and Mary, Queen of Scots. Once you know a little bit of history, these movies are not just Hollywood. It'll give you the true picture of what Protestant England was about. I'm not advocating this. I'm not selling this for any profit. And the best place to get them is to go to Walmart. And the name of the movie, it's a two-movie collection, Anne of a Thousand Days and Mary, Queen of Scots. One movie got 10 Academy Awards and the other one got 5. It's something that you'll cherish and also gain some knowledge. Okay, we're out of time, and I'm going to be back tomorrow night to finish up. So thanks. I thank you for visiting, and make sure you tell somebody and do some research and see if
do you know the Lord? Yes.
Good night.
Do you really know the Lord, who's closer than any brother, closer than any other? Do you really know the Lord? Do you know the